DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
From DW Studios in Bonn, this is Living Planet, and I'm Charlotte Lomas. Coming up on today's show, from the world's remote deserts to the deep depths of the seas, we humans have extracted an abundance of resources to supply the high-tech world we live in today. From smartphones to electric vehicles to sending people into outer space. But our planet's limited resources won't last forever. The global population is expanding rapidly and the future looks uncertain. And that's driving a 21st century gold rush. So can we supply our growing demand by breaking ground in the ever more remote areas of the Earth and beyond?
I think a lunar resource extraction industry will emerge in the next 20 years or so. There is now a growing realization that as space exploration progresses, we may be able to harness some of the energy and material resources of other planets. And this, in the long, quite distant future, might have benefits for the economy of the Earth.
Also on the program, can a virtual currency really harm the environment? All that and more coming up. If you've been tuning in to the news lately, you've probably been hearing the word Bitcoin thrown about. The currency has been making the headlines because it's recently skyrocketed in value, surprising many since it's a virtual currency. Despite its increasing popularity, doubts persist about Bitcoin's longevity, having been likened to tulip mania and described as an economic bubble that's about to burst. But while Bitcoin may not be a currency you can actually hold in your hands, it does have tangible consequences for the environment. In fact, mining Bitcoin is said to use as much energy as that of entire countries like Ireland. To find out more, I spoke with David Malone, a lecturer at Maynooth University in Ireland, and the author of a paper called Bitcoin Mining and Its Energy Footprint. So, David, before we delve into all of that, let's just first quickly recap, what is a Bitcoin exactly?
A Bitcoin it's a unit of currency. So in the same way that you have pounds or dollars, a Bitcoin is something like this, except it was designed by some extremely cunning people who wanted to have a currency that didn't really depend on having a central bank. While we have coins and we have notes to track our money, most of our money is tracked by a bank. They know you have X amount of money in your bank account, and if you give money to somebody else, they take it off you and they give it to them. And so they're tracking who has the money. What the Bitcoin people wanted to do is have a system where instead of having a single group maintaining a ledger of who owned all the money, they wanted a system where everybody could be involved in maintaining this ledger of who owns the money.
What is Bitcoin mining exactly?
The Bitcoin miners are the ones who are maintaining the account of where money has moved in the Bitcoin system. And they are rewarded by getting some extra Bitcoins. And so the designers of Bitcoin's aim was to encourage people to maintain this monetary system by rewarding them with Bitcoins.
Is it sort of like video game meets monetary system?
In some sense it is. This cash is, like much of our real cash, this cash is virtual. It's never turned into a physical object. It's never a note or a coin. It's all maintained on computers. And usually the banks or the credit card agencies maintain the cost of running this system, where in this case, the cost of the system is on the people who are maintaining this account. And to encourage people to get involved, you're being rewarded with Bitcoin as you maintain it.
So if Bitcoin isn't a tangible currency, what value does it have?
It's very like any other thing in society that's rare, but is somehow seen as novel or valuable, acquires a value. And so this is why people are interested in mining it. But the value is really determined by people's interests. So there's a currency exchange with dollars and with euros and with other currencies. And the value of Bitcoin, as we've seen recently, changes a lot from day to day, depending on how interested people are in trading it. And really, as the value increases, the interest in Bitcoin mining also goes up. A lot of it's driven by interest and curiosity. And to some extent, people do make transactions with it, but a lot of the interest is speculative and driven by things like the changes of value in the stock market.
So what is the environmental impact of Bitcoin mining?
So what's happened is people have set up huge groups of computers purely designed for doing this Bitcoin mining. There are apparently whole data centers or warehouses set up in places just devoted to doing really no useful work except for maintaining the Bitcoin accounts.
Who are the people mining Bitcoin and where are they based?
So there are people based all over the world, but as far as we know, a lot of the big mining operations are run in China at the moment. What you really need is cheap electricity to be able to run the mining system. And some changes in regulations in China have meant that data centers can get cheap access to electricity. And so some people have built data centers, struck a deal with the local electricity company, and then use the cheap electricity to get an edge in this Bitcoin mining activity. So there's a cheap coal electricity available in China. If you were doing Bitcoin mining, say, from a renewable source, and you had surplus electricity and you use that for Bitcoin mining, there is more or less zero environmental concern. But if, in fact, a lot of the energy being used for Bitcoin mining is being produced from coal sources, you would have more environmental concerns. And this second scenario seems more likely.
And so the amount of energy being used to mine Bitcoin has been compared to that of entire nations like Ireland. And by 2019, the Bitcoin network will consume half the energy of the United States. Are these estimates realistic?
I think certainly the current estimates are fairly realistic. We know how efficient the computers are people use for Bitcoin mining. There are some very, very efficient hardware has been built for doing this. And if we assume that everybody used the most efficient hardware, we also know how fast people are guessing equations or guessing solutions to these equations, and we can put those two pieces of information together. And if we do that for the end of 2017, it looks like about 1.5 gigawatts was being used as a minimum for Bitcoin mining. Now, in reality, there will be overheads on top of that. Some people have estimated the overheads at 70%. That would be things like cooling to keep all your computers at a sensible temperature, lighting, other things that are needed in the building. And also, probably not everybody is using this most efficient hardware possible. Some people may be using older hardware that's a little bit less efficient. And so that means we're looking at maybe twice 1.5 gigawatts, maybe a little bit more. And that's up around Ireland's energy usage. Ireland's energy usage at the moment varies between about 2.5 gigawatts and 6 gigawatts, depending on the time of day. So it's definitely comparable to Ireland and several other countries.
And each time we see a rise in Bitcoin's value, does that automatically mean its energy consumption is shooting up as well?
It doesn't have to mean it's the case. If nobody else got into the Bitcoin mining game when the value went up, then in fact there would be no increase in electricity usage for the mining. But in fact what happens in practice is as Bitcoin's value increases, more people get interested in mining. More hardware gets devoted to this using more electricity. And so what we see is just an increase in the energy usage. And that seems to fit the pattern that we've seen maybe over most of Bitcoin's lifetime.
Is Bitcoin's energy consumption, do you think, a sign of a growing environmental cost of our economies becoming increasingly digitalized?
Certainly, there is a general concern about electricity usage of not just Bitcoin, but of a lot of aspects of our daily lives. So all the big technological services we use, things like if we're using Google to search, if we're using Apple to download our music, if we're using Netflix to stream our videos, all of these have data centers that are using electricity. But perhaps the value that we're getting from them is a little clearer in some of the other cases. With Bitcoin, it's actually designed where it could work with a much smaller network of people involved. And back in the early days of Bitcoin, there were much smaller networks of people involved. And so it can operate in a kind of satisfactory way with a smaller group of interested people. But if the value increases, more people will get involved. And actually, in one sense, that increases the security of Bitcoin, but it's possible we're paying too large a price for that.
Who pays for the environmental impact of Bitcoin mining?
That's an interesting question. In some cases, say it's you or I and we plug in our laptop at home and we leave it Bitcoin mining, then probably our laptop isn't using a lot of electricity and the cost of that is coming out of the carbon budget for our country, say. Now, in other cases where it's places like China, very often people believe that the contracts are legitimate, that people are buying electricity in a reasonable way, and it will come out of China's budget consequently. There are some fears maybe that people are doing things like either running Bitcoin mining on computers that have been broken into, in which case the computer is in somebody else's house or in somebody else's country and the cost is being incurred there.
So ultimately, if we want to keep our carbon footprint in check, should we be steering clear of Bitcoin?
So Bitcoin in itself, I think there's no way to fix it. As long as its value is high, lots of people will want to mine it and consequently it will have a big energy footprint.
That was David Malone, a lecturer at Maynooth University in Ireland and author of the paper called Bitcoin Mining and Its Energy Footprint.
I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. Hey, hey. Well, I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. Hey, hey. Said I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. And if I share with you my story, would you share your dollar with me?
We leave the world of cryptocurrencies to venture deep down into the underwater world. The oceans hide vast quantities of valuable minerals and metals, and as onshore deposits run low, mining companies are looking for ways to make deep-sea mining both technologically possible and profitable. But what happens when you start rooting around on the seafloor, several kilometres down, where life has existed for possibly billions of years and never before been disturbed by humans? Our reporter Lash Bavanga spoke to some of the leading scientists working hard to find out.
Like most of you probably, I'm completely dependent on my smartphone, and it, along with billions of other devices, is dependent on a range of rare earth metals. These less common elements are needed for things like magnets, batteries, and microchips in all kinds of modern tech. Hello?
The new technologies have basically initiated the new kind of like gold rush. And many of the new technologies, including, for example, wind turbines, the magnets of the wind turbines, they need tons and tons and tons of rare earth elements.
Andrea Koshinsky is a professor of geoscience at Jacobs University in Bremen. When she's not in her office, you'll find her on a scientific vessel overseeing submarines exploring the seafloor. Several kilometres beneath the waves, this is the new frontier for mining companies in search of metals that could soon be in short supply onshore. Koshinsky is trying to find out what that means for life at the bottom of the sea.
Basically, you could describe them as black potatoes. They look a little bit like coal, but they have nothing to do with coal because they have no carbon. They are made of manganese oxides.
Koshinsky shows me some pictures from the seabed, dotted with thousands of small potato-sized black rocks known as nodules.
So you would mine the whole nodule and then try to extract the metals of interest.
And would it be as easy as picking potatoes once you're down there?
In principle, yes. If you have the technology to really move a machine at 4,000 meter water depth in rather soft sediment, it is still associated with high cost in the beginning. But once these investments have been done and some prototypes of well-functioning machines exist, I think it should be possible from both technological and financial side.
Some deep-sea mining machines have already been built. Several countries have bought permits for deep-sea mineral prospecting in a massive 1.2 million square kilometre area in the eastern Pacific. Mining hasn't started yet, but environmentalists are alarmed by the potential impact on ecosystems.
We won't be able to stop it, but we will be able to monitor it in a careful way and make sure that everything is properly done.
Lawrence Thompson works alongside Professor Andrea Koshinsky at the Jacobs University.
They are on the seafloor, work for 1 year, do the baseline study. Then you have.
He's been studying the impact on the seafloor when heavy machines with caterpillar tracks scurry back and forth to collect the metal-rich nodules. Using a robot, his team has studied what they call the snow, tiny particles that whirl up when the seabed is disrupted, and how they affect the fragile creatures living on the seafloor.
Hydrothermal vents. Astonishingly, we now know that they hold as much life as tropical rainforests.
British naturalist David Attenborough in the new BBC series Blue Planet 2, describing the complex ecosystems around so-called hydrothermal vents. These deep-sea chimney-like structures spew out minerals straight from the Earth's core. These two are prospective mining grounds. Still, Andrea Koshinsky at Jacobs University is less worried about the impact of deep-sea mining in areas like this.
The ecosystems are really focused here around the vents. These organisms are adapted to relatively quick and drastic changes. So they live in a toxic environment anyways. Frequently, these systems are hit by volcanic eruptions, and a new vent system comes up. So these vent systems are very dynamic, and probably they can recover relatively quickly.
Here you see a kind of sea anemone. These white spots here might be something like brittle stars. The first thing what we still have to do is make an inventory. What is out there? So this is one of the fears, that we destroy something we have no clue about.
Jens Greinert is head of the Deep Sea Monitoring Research Unit at the Geomar Helmholtz Center for Ocean Research in Kiel. He too works with mapping the areas of our planet which we know the least about and the possible impact of mining there. Much is still unknown, he admits, yet he remains relatively optimistic. If, and it is still an if, deep sea mining takes off big time, at least we will probably have done what we can to prepare and minimize the damage to the environment, he says.
Maybe the first time in humankind we think about the potential environment before actually somebody starts getting resources out of the ground. On land, nobody asked. With oil and gas, nobody asked before. All this regulation has been established afterwards, after a lot of damage has been made. And now we do it jointly together before something is happening.
The world's first major deep-sea mining program is set to begin in the next 2 years in the deep waters off Papua New Guinea. There, a new dedicated deep-sea mining company wants to start looking for copper, zinc, gold and silver. Environmentalists and the mining industry will be monitoring their success, or lack of it, closely. Lars Bevanger, DW, Bremen.
You're listening to Living Planet with me, Charlotta Lomas. Still to come on the show, could mining the moon be Earth's backup plan?
I kind of view it as a kind of long-term insurance policy. Suppose in 100 years' time, we've done everything that we can to minimise humanity's footprint on the planet, but still we hit the finite limits of planet Earth. Then what are we going to do?
This is Houston, AOS, over.
In 1969, in the era of great space exploration, Apollo 11 landed the first man on the moon.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Since then, following decades of lunar missions and research, humans have acquired an incredible understanding of the moon and its surface. And it's thanks to this knowledge that private companies and space agencies are looking yet again to advancing space exploration. Tesla Motors CEO Elon Musk, for instance, wants to colonize Mars and send tourists to the moon. But there's also mounting interest in what some are calling the Galactic Gold Rush. Tech companies have their sights set on space with the aim of mining the moon. That's right, moon mining. It certainly raises a lot of questions, like who even owns the moon, let alone its materials. To find out more, I spoke to Ian Crawford, Professor of Planetary Science and Astrobiology at Birkbeck College in London.
I'm not sure there is really a growing race to mine the moon. I think there is an increasing understanding that throughout human history, the economies of the world have been based on the energy and material resources of just a single planet. So there is now a growing realization that as space exploration progresses, we may be able to harness some of the energy and material resources of other planets. And this, in the long, quite distant future, might have benefits for the economy of the Earth, because it would kind of open up what is currently a closed planetary economy to external sources of energy and raw materials. But I think that is still quite a long way in the future.
So who's driving this push for lunar extraction?
Well, there are a number of private companies which have decided that they want to pursue this, and they've sort of raised the profile of the whole idea of mining the moon and asteroids as well. But it would be true to say they haven't actually got very far yet. Currently, a lot of the near-term focus isn't the idea that we might mine the moon for things that we need on the Earth, but it would be that we would mine the moon for things that we might want to use on the moon in terms of the context of future space exploration. Because if we decide that we wish to continue to explore the moon, say we wish to establish a human outpost on the moon like we have research outposts in Antarctica, then these outposts would be much cheaper to operate if they could use lunar resources, say lunar sources of water, lunar sources of energy, instead of having to lift all this stuff from the Earth to the moon. And the same argument holds for mining asteroids. If we want to build up a capability in space by, let's say, sending astronauts to Mars or building very large telescopes to look for planets around other stars, these facilities would be cheaper to implement if the resources that they were built from and maintained from were sourced in space rather than carried out of Earth's tremendously strong gravity. And here the space agencies do have an interest, because it would make their near-term exploration activities cheaper if it were to work. And these private companies are kind of viewing a market where you would mine resources in space to use in space to make space exploration cheaper. Now, that will happen much more quickly than mining things in space to use on the Earth.
What wealth of resources exist on the moon, and what can we use these materials for?
Well, I think every chemical element in the periodic table that exists on the Earth also exists on the moon, because the Earth and the moon are made from the same materials. Therefore, in a sense, the Earth already has everything that you might hope to find on the moon. There are a couple of suggestions that have been advanced that the moon might uniquely have that might be useful. In terms of energy, so helium-3 has been advocated as a possible future energy source for the Earth because it could in principle be used to power nuclear fusion power stations to produce electricity. Now, mining the moon for helium-3 does have its advocates. It does have some very strident voices arguing for mining the lunar surface for helium-3 for energy production on the Earth. I myself am extremely skeptical about this for a number of reasons. The first reason is helium-3 does exist in the lunar soils, but it exists in really very small quantities, typically concentrations of 4 to 10 parts per billion. Given the extreme rarity of helium-3 in lunar soils, to make any sort of significant contribution to the Earth's likely mid-21st century energy requirements, you'd be talking about having to strip mine many hundreds of square kilometers of lunar soil every year. I mean, this would be an enormous undertaking. It's a bit like a fossil fuel. It's been laid down over millions of years, and then you mine it, and once you've mined it, it's all gone. So if you had this money to invest in securing the world's future energy security, you wouldn't be putting it into yet another non-renewable fuel like helium-3. You'd be putting it into very efficient renewables. Not only do I think mining them in for helium-3 is likely to be impractical, I don't think it's going to be necessary either. And therefore, that does indeed remove one of the key arguments that would-be lunar miners make for the uniqueness of the moon.
And so how likely are we to see a lunar resource extraction industry emerge in the coming decades? How far off is this?
I think a lunar resource extraction industry will emerge in the next 20 years or so, but slowly. It'll start off really with quite a small scale of trying to see how water can be extracted from lunar materials, from asteroid materials. Once that's been demonstrated as practically possible, if it is, then you can envisage how the process will be scaled up to eventually providing all the water that might be required in exploring the inner solar system. And then, once all that infrastructure has been built up, all that capability has been built up, then will be the time to start looking for other raw materials that you might also want to use in space rather than lifting off the surface of the Earth. And that's when you might start looking for lunar sources of metals like titanium or aluminium and gradually start building up the capability to extract them.
And so, say we pull this off fairly soon and we manage to set up lunar resource extraction. Legally speaking, who owns the moon and the materials extracted from it?
So formally, nobody owns the moon, or everybody owns the moon, depending on your interpretation of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. So currently, the Outer Space Treaty is the legal foundation on which all activities in space are built. And it does say some things categorically. One of the things it states categorically is that no nation state can own the moon or any other celestial body. No one can plant a flag on the moon and claim to own the moon. But when the treaty was formulated in 1967, no one had envisaged that private companies might be interested in mining the moon. They might not want to appropriate the entire moon, but they might wish to extract resources and sell those resources. So the Outer Space Treaty is really ambiguous on that point. And it is quite important that it's, before this activity really happens on a large scale, it's really quite important that we get some legal clarity on this issue.
Is there an economic argument for it? Is mining the moon economically feasible?
Well, it depends. Mining the moon for things that you want to use on the moon, yes, certainly this is economically feasible because it saves you having to lift stuff off the Earth to use on the moon. Mining the moon to use for things on the Earth, then no, clearly currently it's not economically feasible.
And is there an environmental case for mining the moon?
Now, the moon actually does have a reasonable concentrations of the rare earth elements. Not everywhere, but there are places on the moon where the rare earth elements are concentrated. So in the, I think, quite distant future, because a lot of infrastructure would clearly need to be developed on the moon before we could mine the moon for rare earth elements. But ultimately, you could imagine an argument being made that if we need these elements for our high technologies, including our green high technologies like electric vehicles and whatnot, there is a long-term environmental possible benefit in mining for extraterrestrial resources, because even though the Earth has a lot of these elements, we damage the Earth by digging them up. Obviously, we should be doing everything we can on the Earth to minimize our footprint on the Earth. So we should be making our economies much more efficient. We should be recycling much more materials. And we should be developing economies in a way that minimize the footprint of the surface of the Earth. And we should be doing that anyway. I kind of view it as a kind of long-term insurance policy. Suppose in 100 years' time, we've done everything that we can to minimize humanity's footprint on the planet, but still the human population has grown to a point where it's so large and there are so many people demanding stuff that despite us being as efficient as possible, we still hit the finite limits of planet Earth. Then what are we going to do? And it's in that context that having the ability to start looking for resources on the moon and the inner solar system could be useful if and when we need it.
That was Ian Crawford, Professor of Planetary Science and Astrobiology, talking about the likelihood and feasibility of mining the moon. And that's all we have time for today. Our program was produced with the help of our studio manager Eliana Giaducci and sound engineer Gert Georgi. You can listen to Living Planet anytime on iTunes and SoundCloud, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at DW Environment. I'm Charlotta Lomas. Until next week.